doctorate in law. He's also the resident liberal at Graceland. A number of years ago was brought to his attention by a member of the First Presidency of the RLDS Church that he should be horsewhipped. Because of that, he had taken up marathon running. But we're pleased to have him here. This is he gave a paper on this same subject on the Kirkland murders a year ago at Sunstone, and this is all part of a planned book on the Kirkland murders. Bill was also called upon as an expert witness in a number of the cases relating to this. He will present his paper, and the respondent will be Dave Schwinneman, who is an assistant U.S. attorney here in Salt Lake, a native of Salt Lake City, has been involved with a number of major cases, the Gary Gilmore case, the Singer Swap case, also has been involved with a task force in the LeBaron murders, and he's kind enough to spend some time with us today. So we'll turn the time over to Bill and Dave. When the time comes for questions, we ask that you come up here to the microphone to ask your questions.
Thank you very much, Steve. In January 1990, law enforcement authorities in Lake County, Ohio, discovered five bodies buried in a barn outside Kirtland. They had been tipped off by Keith Johnson of Latour, Missouri, who said that Jeff Lundgren, formerly a Kirtland Temple tour guide, and until recently a priest in the RLDS Church, had shot and killed Dennis and Cheryl Avery and their three children in that barn and buried them in a pit which Johnson himself had helped dig. The youngest victim was Karen Avery, not yet seven. The murders had occurred 8.5 months previously on April 17, 1989. The house and barn had been unoccupied since Lundgren and his 23 followers had fled Kirtland the day after the murders. The prosecutors had learned that Lundgren shot and killed each of the five Averys himself. He had five men assist by tying up the victims and delivering them to the prophet one at a time to be shot. Lake County Prosecutor Stephen Latourette sought the death penalty for five of the six men at the barn. The exception was Greg Winship. Latourette's information had Winship outside the barn, running a chainsaw during the murders and therefore not as directly involved as the other five. The only person sentenced to death was the prophet himself. The second stiffest penalty was dished out to Ron Luff, who had escorted the victims one at a time to the barn. I served as expert witness for the defense of both of these two, and they got the worst penalties, so you can see how effective I was. He was convicted in a jury trial and received 170 years, that is Luff. He is not eligible for parole for 130 years. The most criticized trial was that of Damon Lundgren, 18, the oldest of the prophet's four children. Damon received a 120-year sentence. He's not eligible for parole for 108 years. Danny Kraft received a 50-year sentence. He's eligible for parole in 37 years. Two men who were at the barn plea bargained. Greg Winship, the man with the power saw, did not get much of a break for his plea bargaining efforts. He was sentenced to 75 years to life, although he's eligible for parole in 20 years. The other plea bargainer got the clear break. Richard Brand was the only co-defendant to receive concurrent sentences. The rest all received consecutive sentences. Brand was sentenced to 15 years to life and will be eligible for parole after 10.5 years. Three women members of this cult were in the farmhouse during the murders. Debbie Oliveras and Sharon Blunchley admit knowing what was going on out at the barn. Susan Luff denies advance knowledge. They all were charged with five counts of complicity to commit aggravated murder, five counts of conspiracy to commit aggravated murder, and five counts of kidnapping. Each could have received 150 years to life. They all plea bargained and got 7 to 25-year sentences. They are eligible for parole after 4 years, which means they should be out of prison in 1994. Five adult cult members were not at the farm during the murders. They happened to be the persons who the prophet had known for the longest time. All five became acquainted with the future prophet in their days as students at Central Missouri State University in the late 1960s and up to the mid-1970s. At the time the murders were being committed, two married couples, Dennis and Tanya Patrick and Keith and Kathy Johnson, these people from CMSU, were at their apartment across the street from the Kirtland Police Station, along with their five children. The two Patricks and the Johnsons, excuse me, the two Patricks and Kathy Johnson were charged with obstruction of justice and served less than 1 year each. Keith Johnson, the informer, was not charged with a crime. The one remaining cult member who was indicted was Alice Lundgren, the wife of the cult prophet. She was the furthest away from the scene of the crime. She was shopping in a nearby community buying picnic tables, accompanied by her second son, Jason, 15. The cult members were planning to leave for the wilderness in West Virginia to prepare for the return of Christ. The picnic tables were to be taken on that journey. The toughest call for the prosecutor was what to do with the prophet's wife, Alice. Did her distance from the scene of the crime constitute lack of knowledge and lack of involvement, or was she a wife who was fully aware of and supportive of her husband's plans? Was she a confidant of her prophet husband, helping him make decisions and so forth? On the other hand, maybe Alice was a helpless woman, controlled by a domineering husband who effectively used his authority as prophet to ensure total compliance. Should the state of Ohio throw the book at Alice, or should she be let off easily, like the Johnsons and the Patricks? Is a wife legally obligated to report her husband's that her husband has planned or committed a felony, for example? The people of Lake County, Ohio, were rightfully outraged at these cold-blooded murders. Lake County prosecuting attorney Stephen Latourette was particularly outraged. The state of Ohio decided to throw the book at Alice. She was charged with five counts each of complicity and conspiracy to commit aggravated murder and kidnapping. The prosecutors knew it would be their toughest case to make to prove Alice guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Evidence of Alice's knowledge and involvement was not plentiful. Her physical distance from the scene of the crime was a problem. To Alice's misfortune, her trial came first. The people of Lake County, Ohio, wanted blood. Alice's was the first blood they could draw, type O. She was convicted and sentenced to 150 years. She's eligible for parole in 115 years, in the year 2105, you know, very early in the 22nd century. Why did Alice Lundgren receive a stiffer sentence than four of the five men who directly assisted her husband with the murders? Was justice done in the case of the state of Ohio versus Alice Lundgren? I think not. Here I am not so much interested in making a technical legal argument that she didn't get a fair trial. Her case is under appeal, and a decision should soon be reached by Ohio's 11th District Court of Appeals. I will take a closer look at the legal arguments before I finish the book I'm working on. But what I'm interested in today is the extent Alice should be seen as responsible for the murders that her husband committed. Let's take a very brief look at Alice Lundgren's life. As a child, Alice Elizabeth Keeler had very low self-esteem. She was not an attractive woman, but she was very personable. By her teen years, she had become a very devout member of the RLDS Church. At a church youth camp in 1969, when she was 18, she was told by a patriarch that she would marry a man who would do a great work helping to establish Zion. They call them patriarchs. 2 or 3 months later, she was enrolled at Central Missouri State University at Warrensburg, where she met early on, through church activities, a sophomore named Jeff Lundgren. He came from a devout church family and in Independence, Missouri, and his parents were of higher socioeconomic status than Alice's family. On their dates, Alice and Jeff loved to talk about the Book of Mormon and Zion. Inspired by this discussion, their relationship blossomed, and soon Jeff pressured Alice into engaging in sexual intercourse. Shortly after their first intercourse, Alice received her patriarchal blessing, which admonished her to eschew the ways of the world. Alice began to feel guilty about their sexual activity and wanted to quit until they got married. Jeff would have none of that. He told Alice that she had unleashed something he couldn't stop. Soon he asked Alice to marry him. Jeff's parents opposed the marriage, apparently because Alice's family was of lower status and were not even moderately prominent in the RLDS Church. So Jeff and Alice decided to get pregnant, and on Tuesday, May 5th of her freshman year, the day after Kent State, that is in 1970, Alice and Jeff Lundgren had the classic shotgun marriage. In the 20 years they were together as a married couple, Jeff emotionally, physically, and sexually abused Alice. He told her that she was dumb, you know, stupid bitch. He told her to drop out of college. Women don't need higher education. She was made to ask his approval for everything. He wouldn't let her socialize with other people. He wouldn't let her work outside the home, a couple of cases where she would be working at the same place Jeff worked. He opened her mail. He often denied her access to the phone, would unplug it while he was gone. Listened in when he would let her talk on the phone. He completely controlled the finances and told Alice that it was none of her business. She was rarely allowed to write a check and often didn't know whether Jeff even had a bank account or not. The prophet demanded complete submission, citing dehumanizing nonsense from the scriptures about wives being submissive to their husbands. Resistance to Jeff's complete authority resulted in severe punishment. Jeff raped Alice on numerous occasions, including one rape 5 days after Alice gave birth to their second child. He demanded frequent sex, which was often designed to inflict pain rather than pleasure. When his cult group got underway in the mid-1980s at Kirtland, Jeff often made statements indicating that they would have to kill certain persons because they were infidels or unrepentant, such as the RLDS stake president, who's now my stake president in Iowa, and the stake bishop, and other RLDS leaders and members in Kirtland. And he also threatened to kill at various times former cult member Kevin Curry, who fled, and the ex-husband of cult member Debbie Olivares. And he also threatened to kill at various times cult members Greg Winship, Richard Brand, Sharon Blunchley, all of whom are now in prison, Dennis Patrick, his wife Tanya, and their 10-year-old daughter Molly, and even his own wife Alice herself. When Jeff and Alice were Kirtland Temple tour guides, one night Alice woke up and Jeff was standing over her with a pistol pointed in her face and said, "Don't make me use this." In the weeks prior to April 17th, 1989, the day of the murders, the prophet's violent threats were aimed at the five members of the Dennis and Cheryl Avery family more than anyone else. You can see that there were quite a few threats made over the previous 4 years or so. Prior to April 17th, none of these threats were ever carried out, including the threat to take over the Kirtland Temple 1 year earlier and kill several RLDS leaders. This threat had been leaked, and the FBI was investigating it at the time of the Avery murders. Early in 1989, Jeff began to talk about killing 10 of his followers on the grounds that Moroni lost 10 men protecting the plates. And also there were some members of the group who were hopelessly unrepentant and therefore would prevent the group from seeing Jesus Christ, whose return was imminent if Jeff's disciples could get their act together. The Averys were only on occasion invited to Jeff's scripture classes, which were held almost every evening at the home. At classes that the Averys were not present, the prophet would intimate that the Averys would have to die. Jeff left the group members uncertain as to who the other five might be. The prophet was very good at devising means of social control. Alice asserts that Jeff assured her that these threats were just tests of faith, like the Abraham and Isaac story, which has horrified countless little children in Sunday school over the years. Accordingly, Alice claims that when Jeff ordered her to go shopping for picnic tables on the night of April 17th, she did not think Jeff would be killing the Averys while she was gone. But the prosecutors convinced the jury that Alice knew the Averys were going to be killed and that she was supportive of the idea, and that's why she left. Alice was convicted and sentenced, as we said, to 150 years. In short, for 20 years, Alice was abused by her husband and then had her trial. I would argue she was abused by the state of Ohio. This abuse is scheduled to last for the rest of her life unless she can find the vitamins that Methuselah was taking. I think it is no accident that Jeff Lundgren kept the five persons who had known him the longest away from the farm during the murders. He had met Keith Johnson in the fall of 1968 at Central Missouri University. Keith had introduced Jeff to his future wife when Alice arrived as a freshman the next year. Keith frequently loaned Jeff his car for dates with Alice. Jeff and Alice lost their virginity in the back seat of Keith's car. Now, out our way in Iowa, we have a lot of small school districts, and we're so poor that we often have to use the same car for driver's education and for sex education. I don't know if that's true here in Iowa or in Utah or not. But anyway, the future prophet met Keith Johnson's wife, Kathy, at the time of their marriage in 1975. And at about the same time, he met Dennis and Tanya Patrick, who were students at the time. Dennis later would participate in the ordination of Jeff Lundgren to the office of priest in the RLDS Church in 1983. In our church, we don't automatically ordain men, nor women either. Rather, a specific call, allegedly from God, must come through the pastor or other church administrative officer calling a particular individual to a particular office. Pity poor Tom Richards, the pastor in Independence, who was responsible for claiming that God was calling to the priesthood a man who already was a liar, a thief, an adulterer, and a wife abuser, and who just 5.5 years later, after his ordination, would add mass murder to his list of accomplishments. These five people who were not at the farm when the murders took place knew the prophet the best at that time and the time that he committed these murders. They were more aware of the prophet's human frailties than the others, than the younger people in the cult. They would be more likely to question Jeff and resist his orders to participate in a killing. The younger men knew little of Jeff's unsavory past and were less likely to question his authority. As they say, younger men make better soldiers. They are more likely to accept authority without question. There were three judges assigned to the 13 cases. Alice drew the worst judge from a defense perspective, Judge Paul Mitrovic, Maximum Paul, as he's known, or he's known as a hanging judge. He never gives concurrent sentences. He showed his reputation was well-earned when he gave consecutive sentences to 18-year-old Damon Lundgren, a high school senior at the time of the murders. He did this even though Damon broke down and cried after the first murder and was not able to participate in the rest of them. But Damon was convicted of 4 murders anyway, and several hundred Kirtland area residents sent a petition of sympathy to Damon to Judge Mitrovic, but Maximum Paul sentenced him to 120 years. Judge Mitrovic rejected a plea bargain agreement wherein Alice would have served about 11 years. So Alice went to trial for complicity in conspiracy and kidnapping. Her trial was a travesty. Judge Mitrovic expressed hostility to Alice in pretrial proceedings, but did not excuse himself from the case when the defense filed a motion. Alice's motion for a change of venue was denied, even though in the Lake County media market there were nearly 1,000 newspaper articles and television news stories in the case prior to the trial. During the trial, Judge Mitrovic allowed testimony that had no bearing on Alice's guilt or innocence. He allowed testimony regarding what happened after the cult fled from Kirtland, including sensational testimony regarding a bizarre scene 3 months later when the prophet had 4 women in the group, 2 one day and 2 the next, danced naked before him, one at a time, while he masturbated. If the prophet failed to ejaculate in 1 hour, the woman and her family would be destroyed. If he did ejaculate, she and her husband and children would be saved. In baseball terms, the prophet went 4 for 4. All souls were saved. His semen was the equivalent of the blood of Christ. Interesting new theology here. Saving souls when shed for them. Bizarre events like this, you know, having no relation to the murder 3 months earlier, were admitted by Judge Mitrovic. The prosecutors were allowed to bring into the courtroom plastic bags containing the mud-caked, bloody clothes worn by the victims on the night of their deaths, which had been, of course, now more than a year ago. The courtroom was stinking so badly the bailiff had to open the windows. The jury was shown the small white T-shirt of 6-year-old Karen Avery, the T-shirt which had ponies dancing across the rainbow. They were shown a blouse belonging to Trina Avery, 15, showing 2 bullet holes that pierced the shirt between palm trees and a tiger's head. Judges in Ohio are elected, and I guess, you know, it's controversial as what effect that has, but it appears that Mitrovic's pretrial statements reflected popular hostility toward Alice. His denial of venue reflects his desire to get the favorable public notice that he would get in a trial in his home county before the home folks, thus his willingness to admit evidence of questionable relevance. The state's case against Alice was essentially in 7 parts. 1, the prosecution put on testimony which suggested that Alice, as the wife of the prophet, had special status above all others, except her prophet husband. She was portrayed as the 2 person in the cult, the queen bee, the confidant of the prophet who was in on his thinking and his plans. She was portrayed as the cheerleader for the prophet who continually reinforced her husband's teachings and plans with her supportive words. The prophet taught evening scripture classes frequently. In these classes, cult witnesses testified, the prophet would occasionally assert that the repenting would likely never repent and thus would have to be destroyed in accordance with the Book of Mormon's warning, repent or be destroyed. The witnesses indicated that Alice was at the classes when these comments were made. Debbie Oliveras testified that a discussion was held as to how the Avery should be killed, according to the scriptures. Should 13-year-old Becky be killed in the manner adult women should be killed, or should her head be bashed against the rocks, the way scriptures say children should be killed? Debbie testified that Alice suggested it would depend upon whether 13-year-old Becky had begun menstruation. Thirdly, testimony was given indicating that Jeff and Alice had dinner with the Averys at their home about a week before the murders. for the purpose of checking out the Avery's possessions to determine what they had that would be useful to take into the wilderness after they'd been killed. Thus was created in the minds of a jury a grisly scene at the dinner table of the future victims. Fourthly, Debbie Olivares testified that she had driven to the grocery store with Alice on the morning of the murders. She reports Alice as having said the Averys were ripe with iniquity. They were so sinful there was no hope they could repent. Fifthly, Sharon Blunchley, the co-defendant who had lived the longest with the prophet and his family, testified that she rode to the bank with Alice in the early afternoon of the day of the murders. She recalls Alice as saying, "Sharon, I'm so proud of you. You've done what you are supposed to do. Tonight's the night for the Averys. You know, for the longest time, you and Richard," that's her husband, "were supposed to be in the pit with the Averys." Sixthly, another plea bargaining co-defendant, Greg Winship, testified that Alice, quote, "asked how I felt about people like the Averys having to die for my sins." And then finally, the most damning testimony the prosecution offered was a videotaped statement that Alice made to federal authorities in San Diego shortly after her arrest, and one day after she had tried to commit suicide with alcohol and drugs with Jeff's help, and asked if she was aware that the Averys had been brought to the farm to be killed, she answered, quote, "I suspected they were. You had to be stupid not to know what Jeff was up to." The four co-defendants who plea bargained struck a deal in which they agreed to testify, and if they testified truthfully, the prosecution would dismiss some of the charges against them and go easy on them. But sentencing of the plea bargainers would not be held until after all the trials were over. Thereby, the prosecutors maintained some leverage over the plea bargainers. As is usually the case in crimes where there are multiple defendants, soon it became each defendant for herself or himself. Past friendships often come to a screeching halt as each one tries to skin. One danger in this kind of arrangement is that plea bargainers might say what they know the prosecution wants to hear in order to make lenience on them more probable. While I don't think Debbie or Sharon consciously lied, I suspect the prosecution helped them remember the events surrounding the murders in ways that would unfairly implicate Alice. They both quite naturally laid some blame on Alice, since Alice had frequently been vocal in support of what Jeff was doing in his roles as both prophet of God and domineering patriarchal head of an enlarged family. For Alice, the only realistic choice usually was support Jeff or suffer his brutality. The self-interest of the plea bargainers, their bias against Alice, and the knowledge that the prosecution had a lot of control over their lives may have tainted their memories a bit. It is my view that Alice was not guilty of the serious crimes for which she was committed. I believe her culpability for these murders was rather slight. Let me respond to the case for the prosecution just outlined. Number one, Alice could hardly be seen as the second most influential person in the cult. The prophet believed in patriarchy in the extreme. He held that the women must be totally submissive. He treated Alice as if she were brainless. I find no convincing evidence that Alice occupied a position above that of the men in the group, especially those men who Jeff respected. I see her as clearly less influential than Ron Luff, Greg Winship, Danny Kraft, and his son Damon. At the time of the murders, it's possible that Debbie Olivares, Jeff's cousin, was trusted with more information than Alice. Alice recalls that on occasions when she asked Jeff what he was thinking, he would tell her that it was none of her business, or that he would tell her that what he was thinking when he felt she needed to know. For Jeff, it was a rare time when Alice needed to know anything other than his orders, which were almost always designed to serve him. Interestingly, when Ron Luff and Damon Lundgren were tried, the prosecution depicted them as number two in the cult. Furthermore, even if Alice had special status as Queen Bee, and even if she served as cheerleader for Jeff, that is irrelevant unless she served as cheerleader for Jeff's plans to kill the Averys. Secondly, on the second part of the state's case, Alice says that she was not at all the classes, and those who testified that the Averys were mentioned normally recall vague references that would not be clear unless persons could read between the lines. Jeff often spoke metaphorically rather than specifically, and Alice denies that she made the suggestion about how to kill Becky Avery. Third, the dinner at the Averys a few days before the murders is easy to interpret in Alice's favor. The Averys were expecting to go into the wilderness with the rest of the Lundgren core group. Everyone was making preparations, selling or discarding unneeded property. Alice could have been fully expecting the Averys to accompany them on the trip. Jeff was making decisions about what property group members should take with them and what should be left behind. Jeff would make that decision for the Averys, hard as it is for us to believe, just as he did for everyone else. A man who opens your mail, screens your phone calls, which the prophet did for everyone at the farm, can certainly make these decisions for you as well. Lots of group members were ordered to sell or trash items they held dear in accordance with the prophet's personal judgment. So Jeff needed to visit the Avery's home and see what they had that he wanted. On point four, Alice could have certainly made the statement that the Avery's were ripe for iniquity and were hopelessly unrepentant. That doesn't mean she knows Jeff will kill them or even that she thinks they should be killed by anyone, including God herself. Alice was making the supportive wife, was being the supportive wife, the cheerleader. Fifthly, if Alice said to Sharon, "Tonight's the night for the Avery's," it could have simply reflected Alice knowing that the Avery's were coming for dinner to be given a last chance to repent. Alice is reported to have made this statement in the context of congratulating Sharon because she had been spared. She was going to be one of the ten. Alice claims that as Jeff moved into his more bizarre ideas, threatening the death of the unrepentant, she worked very hard to see to it that Jeff didn't carry through on his threats. An example of this would be her discussion with Jeff about, "Are you going to really kill them?" And he said, "No, it's a test of faith." Possibly Alice was convinced that Jeff would not kill anyone, but went along with any crazy idea at the moment that fell short of something so stupid. Sixthly, Alice's alleged statement to Greg Winship, "How do you feel about the Avery's having to die for your sins?" could also fit into that category. That is, Alice going along with Jeff's using this as a test of faith to ensure greater control over his people. Such conduct by Alice may be despicable, but it does not appear to me to be criminal. And finally, on the toughest one, Alice's statement on the videotape, quote, you had to be stupid not to know what he was up to. Alice says that her statement was a criticism of herself. She was stupid not to realize that Jeff was actually going to kill through with this threat that night, as she looked back at it afterward. Throughout her life, Alice had been convinced by her husband and other relatives that she was stupid. Alice faced a hostile press, especially from the newspaper that serves Lake County, the News Herald, published in Willoughby, the town immediately north of Kirtland. The Painesville Telegraph expired here a few years ago. Mormons, I'm sure, were probably tickled if they heard it. For example, Alice was portrayed as cold and emotionless at her trial in the local media, in the News Herald. Yet Maggie Martin of the Cleveland Plain Dealer noted that Alice often hung her head and sobbed as the coroner described the Avery's wounds. She dabbed her eyes with tissues throughout the lengthy description of the Avery's autopsies. She was photographed crying during the trial in some newspapers, yet she was labeled in the News Herald, the local paper, and other media as a cold cult matriarch who had no remorse. So in conclusion, the prosecution convinced the jury that Alice was a co-conspirator with her husband in planning the cold-blooded murders of the Avery's. In my judgment, Alice was a woman with low self-esteem, made even lower and lower through 20 years of abuse at the hands of her husband. I see her as torn between her desire for Jeff to be the man of God that a patriarch had told her he was going to be, yet terrified of what Jeff would do next, to her or to others in the group. I see her as not approving of the murders, and I believe she went shopping on the night of April 17th, assuming that Jeff would once again not carry through with his threats and conclude that the Avery's had repented and could live, just as he had done with the other five people who had slated for death just a few days before that, as well as several other persons who he had earlier threatened to kill in the name of God. Thank you.
Well, folks, I was asked to come and respond to Bill's paper. They told me I was going to be coming and talking about Mormon mass murderers, and I wondered whether they were asking me to come and do a how-to. I've been involved in practically every one that's happened, with the exception of this one. I'm glad I wasn't involved in this one, frankly. These are not easy cases as a prosecutor to deal with, and I know for the Mr. La Tourette and Karen Lawson and Sandra Dre in Ohio, this case I'm sure was one that they'll live with the rest of their lives, just like some of the ones I've done live with me constantly. There are a couple of things that I'd like to take issue with as far as Mr. Russell's paper is concerned. With all due respect, I think Mr. Russell has indicated that he didn't want to make a legal argument, but in the end, what we've done is we've had Mr. Russell assume the role of a jury of one and review the evidence in his own mind and come to a separate or a different conclusion than the jury who sat through the trial came to. In the homicide cases that I've had anything to do with, in the cult-related or religious-related, religious-founded homicides that I've had to prosecute and assemble evidence in and present to a jury, present that evidence to a jury, I've found that things aren't quite as cut and dried as that. They aren't quite as clear as that. First of all, a disclaimer, I was not at the trial. I did not participate in the preparation of the case. I did not have the opportunity to see all the evidence, and I, of course, didn't see the evidence presented if I wasn't at trial. I have had a chance to read Pete Early's book, and I've read the book by Cynthia Sasser, or Sassy, I believe is her name. And I've read some of the portions of the transcript that were available in those couple of works, and I think I come to a couple of different conclusions. And one of the things I'd like to do is just talk about some of those different conclusions first, and then talk about maybe some of the bigger issues that these kinds of cases, the kind of case that this particular case illustrates and the kind of cases I've been involved in illustrates, some bigger issues, some bigger concerns and considerations for people that think the way we do, that are raised the way we were raised, that are perhaps brought up to think of things in a different way than most people in the world. First of all, with respect to the toughest call, I'm not sure that the toughest call that Mr. LaTourette had was whether or not to charge Alice. I think the toughest call he had was whether or not to plea bargain with Alice. And he makes that fairly clear, or that's made fairly clear in Pete Early's book, when he talks about LaTourette having to decide whether or not they had a strong enough case against Alice to proceed to trial, and then determining that because they felt somewhat weak, and partly because of the distance that she had put between herself and the scene of the crime, that he determined that he would entertain a plea bargain in her case. What Mr. Russell has slid over is the notion that a judge, in the case of a plea bargain, is the final arbiter. The prosecution and the defense get together on a plea bargain. They agree that certain things ought to happen. They agree that there are certain limits that it should be placed on a sentence, for example, or certain things that should happen to a defendant. And in the end, they propose that plea bargain to the representative of the people, who is the judge in this case, and he decides whether that plea bargain is going to be in the best interest of the public. We've had plea bargains that have been rejected in this jurisdiction because the judges have felt that it was in the best interest of the public to see this matter tried. Now, a person doesn't have an absolute right to plead guilty. A person has a right to a jury trial or a right to have their case tried to a jury or to a judge, if that's how it works, and to have that matter resolved to the satisfaction of the trier of fact. And that resolution is a resolution beyond a reasonable doubt, not any doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt. Judge in this case simply decided, as I understand it, that this matter was not to be pled, this matter was to be tried. And as a result, Alice Lundgren, through no fault of the prosecutor and through no fault of the charging decision or the plea bargaining process, with the exception of what the judge did, was not permitted the plea bargain, which I believe would have given her maybe 5 to 8 years as opposed to 150. So we need to place responsibility for these things in the right place. Now, Alice drawing first blood with Alice, the correct juxtaposition of these cases is different. Jeffrey Lundgren was scheduled for trial first. I believe that's the way the prosecutors wanted it. That's the way the trial calendars worked out. And in the end, Jeffrey Lundgren, because of what I think was a rather courageous act on the part of his defense counsel, Mr. LaPlante, was able to obtain a continuance to allow Mr. Plant to become better prepared. The judge had forced Mr. LaPlante into a very tough situation where he didn't feel as though he had enough information to go forward with a trial that had been scheduled to begin, first of all, and that Mr. LaTourette was going to try. They wanted to get, as we call it, a good sting in before they tried everybody else. Mr. LaPlante simply went into the judge, informed the judge that he was quitting the case, and that if the judge didn't allow him to quit the case, and that if the judge wanted to go forward without an attorney, that would be fine, but there would be a miscarriage of justice. The judge dismissed Mr. LaPlante that day, thought about it, brought him all back in, sentenced him. I feebly found him in contempt, sentenced him to a 10-day period of contempt, which he then suspended to 8 days and granted the continuance. So if you throw a tantrum, folks, it works sometimes. We don't throw tantrums. We sort of tolerate them, but we don't throw them. As a consequence, it threw, as I understand it, it threw the prosecution strategy on its head. because Alice Lundgren was the next trial that was scheduled to commence. And oddly enough, the trial commenced, I believe, on July the 24th. Which, when we tried Adam Swap and Tim Singer, we had, through an odd quirk of calendaring fate, a trial date of April the 6th. Now, all of you who are knowledgeable know the significance of April the 6th. Well, so did Adam, and he believed that April the 6th was the ordained day for his trial to commence, and as a consequence would tolerate no continuances, would tolerate no change in that date. Neither would the judge, so we were forced into a situation that was not unlike Mr. LaPlante's, but we couldn't throw a tantrum big enough to get our case changed. Nonetheless, it was Alice that went first, but not by any choice or any design of anyone's. It was simply a matter of the calendaring and of the fact that Jeffrey Lundgren's case couldn't go at that time. The question, was justice done in Alice's case, has many facets. One is the legal facet, and the only people that are going to be able to decide that correctly are the Ohio Appeals Court that now have the case. If there were technical legal problems associated with the trial sufficient to throw that verdict into question, I have confidence in the system enough to know that the Ohio Appeals Court will find those errors and will make those adjustments. It may require an adjustment in sentencing. It may require an adjustment in the trial, to the extent that the trial may have to be done again. I know, as a prosecutor and a person who's done these kinds of cases, the very last thing that you want to have happen, believe me, is a retrial of anything. You do not, contrary to popular belief, take advantage at trial with the hope that you're going to get a conviction and then everything will go away. We fought appeals in every case that I've ever been involved in of this nature for years. The Singer Swap appeals were not finished for almost 3 years. We finished them just about a year and a half ago. And we literally turned over every stone in those cases. So as a prosecutor who knows he's going to look at an appeals court that's not going to be as sympathetic as a jury, maybe, or maybe not as attuned to what went on and is a little more distant and objective, you want to make sure you try your cases and try them well the first time. You don't count on things getting better for you after it's over. Now, admittedly, the burden after a conviction is on the defense to show that the errors were sufficient to throw that verdict into question, and that burden is considerable. But I've found in my experience that in high-profile cases, that burden becomes somewhat less of a problem for the defense than it would be in an ordinary case. Now, justice in another sense, moral justice, was moral justice done to Alice? As the Israeli Supreme Court said in its written decision in the Denumniak case that they issued about 2.5 weeks ago, the very last line in that decision, as I read it in the New York Times, was that human judges will not know all the truth. And I think that's true of any criminal proceeding. The justice system is not a perfect system. It's the best thing we've got. It is flawed in some respects because it relies on human beings to do the work in the system. But if you're talking about moral justice, the legal system is not necessarily the place, oddly enough, that you're going to find moral justice. You will find the best you can get by way of legal justice. If you're talking about political justice, emotional justice, I don't know. Maybe we're not in a position to say. We don't participate in politics in Ohio, and emotionally we're not equipped to make those decisions or those determinations. If you're talking about responsibility as that relates to Alice's history, it is a very pathetic history. I'm not sure you could go as far as to say sympathetic history. It is a pathetic history. It had turns and twists from the beginning that molded Alice, that created the person that in the end was involved with Jeffrey Lundgren to the extent that she is now facing 150 years in prison. She will spend the rest of that life in a prison cell unless things change. Jeffrey Lundgren was also a person who, through twists and turns of fate, twists and turns in his life, molded a pathology that resulted in what he did at the Avery Farm on April the 17th. And I think those maybe are some of the bigger issues that I'd like to discuss when I finish here. But if you're talking about responsibility and Alice's responsibility for what happened, her history, as I say, may be pathetic, but it is not a justification for the offense for which he was committed, which he was convicted. The fact that you're an abused person in Ohio, as I understand it, an abused spouse, and this defense was proposed to the trial court, is a defense in Ohio if you happen to murder the person that's abusing you. It's allowed, wife abuse syndrome or the abused victim syndrome is permitted if you are killing the person that is administering the abuse to you. It was not allowed in this particular case because, as the court said, we're talking about the murders of third parties, not the murder of the abuser. And as a consequence, that particular defense was not permitted. I would argue that that is appropriate under the circumstances. Society cannot accept allowing someone who believes themselves to be abused or downtrodden to use that as an excuse for killing third parties. We had that situation in LeBaron's. We have that situation in Dr. Allred homicide that Rena Chenoweth committed along with the Marsden woman. We would have it, and I'm sure we're going to get it in the Koresh case. As I say, I tried the LeBaron case in Houston, and that defense was raised. Simply stated, society can't function if you're allowing someone who has a doctrinal belief to act out on those beliefs and cause the kind of damage that was caused in this kind of case. It's simply a policy question, and that's been decided. And I don't think you can fault either the Ohio court or common sense for that. In another sense, the Manson case would be defensible on the same grounds. I defend myself against the crime of homicide that Charlie got me to do because I just sort of lost my head for a while and became a devotee to the extent that I couldn't think for myself. Absent a mental defense, an honest-to-goodness mental illness defense, where because of some organic defect or some disease or illness, I don't have the capacity for knowing right from wrong. I don't believe personally that there ought to be a defense of this kind of duress. Now, there is a duress defense in the law, but this is not a duress-type situation. A duress defense exists when you have a gun to your head or when you have someone that you love that has a gun to their head, is in risk of imminent damage or danger, and you are then asked or forced under those circumstances to do something that you would not do otherwise. This is not a situation, as I read the facts, and again, I was not there, that would lend itself to a duress defense. And I don't believe a duress defense was even raised. It may have been discussed, but I don't believe the duress defense was actually even proposed to the jury. To summarize that point, I don't think a pathology, absent a mental illness or disease, can be a defense to this type of conduct or activity. Now, in terms of the judge's role at trial, Mr. Russell has made a point that the bag of clothing and certain photographs were allowed to be shown to the jury. That's a trial issue that's taken care of during the trial or before trial in a motion, what's called a motion in limine. The judge in this case, I remind Mr. Russell, did make a decision with respect to a photograph of Cheryl Avery's face where the tape had eroded away after they'd taken her out of the pit, showed her face to be in a contorted scream, I believe. And that photograph is not allowed by Judge Markovitz to be shown to the jury. In at least that case, the judge decided that it would be more prejudicial than probative, which is the standard, and decided that photograph would not be shown. Insofar as the clothing, the fact that the clothing is a year old made that process rather distasteful. The prosecutors themselves, when they first viewed the clothing, had a very difficult time handling that situation. I was involved in the Hi-Fi murder case, too. And when we were doing the last stages of the appeals, just before the execution, we went up and removed all of the materials that were kept in the basement of the Ogden, in the Weber County building there. They'd been kept in a very small part of the basement in a locked compartment. Hadn't been seen since the homicides were committed. We went down because we wanted to make sure that we had a good idea of what we were dealing with evidence-wise. We'd been working this thing for years, but hadn't actually gone down to see the evidence. We pulled all the physical evidence out, spread it out, and looked at all of it. And it is very distasteful. It's emotionally difficult to do, especially if you know the context of the case. It's just physically distasteful. It smells. It's difficult to handle and deal with. that was the situation the prosecutors found themselves in when they looked at this evidence. There was, to be fair, an idea on the part of one of the prosecutors, at least, to bring that scene home to the jury by showing that particular material. There is also another reason for showing that material, and having been involved in a lot of homicide trials, I can tell you. One of the facts that had to be proven in this case was that the murders that they were accused of conspiring to commit and their complicity was associated with kidnapping related to, they had to prove that the murders actually had been committed. So in order to do that, they had to put on medical examiners that testified about the autopsies, medical examiners who talked about entry and exit wounds for the bullets, and clothing to show that they were, killed at close range, that the bullet holes matched the bullet holes on the bodies. That would go to show that they were killed at the same time that the holes were made in the clothing and the bodies, as opposed to somewhere else and dressed. And there are all kinds of issues that are related to the physical handling of that kind of case, and I do not fault the prosecutors for putting that evidence on. Apparently the judge didn't either, felt that it was important. As far as plea bargaining is concerned, I can answer from a prosecutor's point of view that in an encapsulated crime like this is, in a crime like the LeBarons or a crime unlike the Swaps, the world watched the Swap case. We had videotapes and 150 witnesses and people all watching. We still didn't know what was going on inside the building. Still didn't know what was going on. A crime like this one, the only people that are really knowledgeable about what's going on in the planning stages and, in fact, in the carrying out stages are the people that are actually involved in the crime. That's the nature of this kind of an offense. In the LeBaron case, 6 years we worked on the LeBaron case, starting back when Dan Jordan was murdered in San Pete County in October of 1987. 6 years we've worked on that. 6 years we worked on it before we finally got the people that were responsible for the four homicides in Houston and Dallas to trial. The trial happened this last January. The only way that case broke, we had all the physical evidence, we had all the information that we needed, we had intelligence coming out of our ears, we've been following these people all over the country and throughout Mexico. But the only way that case broke was when on a Friday afternoon last May, I got a call from Mexico from one of the family members who was afraid she was going to be killed within a few days, who wanted to come over and told us that they would meet us in Laredo and that she would bring one of her other sisters. And when that happened, we went to Laredo, talked to these people, and they eventually disclosed all of the intricate details of the family and how all of these events were carried out, how the homicides were planned, and how the people that were the targets of the homicides were actually executed. That's the only way we found out. And how did we get them to testify, and how were we able to get them to participate in our investigation? By promising one of them the witness protection program and granting her immunity for her role in the offenses, and by promising another, Richard LeBaron, a person who'd killed an 8-year-old child and her father, a lesser sentence in exchange for his evidence and testimony. Now, it's not a comfortable situation. In fact, when we did the jury selection in Houston, one of the questions that we asked repeatedly of each of the jurors that were candidates for that particular trial, for jurors in that particular trial, was, would you hold it against the government if the government had granted immunity to someone who had actually committed a homicide in connection with this case in exchange for their evidence or testimony? And there, frankly, and understandably, were a number of people who said they would, and would not want the government to act in that fashion just to get evidence in order to try these people. But prosecutors make tough decisions all the time, and that's one of them that we make, and that's one of them that we made in LeBaron's, and I trust that Mr. LaTourette and the others involved in that prosecution were faced with basically the same set of mental problems and decisions that we were faced with, and that is, do you try this case? Do you bring the bigger players to trial? Do you try and do justice on a broader scale, or do you not deal? And in these kinds of cases, you simply have to deal. Prosecutors rely on self-interest, and they rely on the fear on the part of these people that are coming to them to get them to turn. That's as clear as it can be, and it can't be stated any better. Were it not for a person's self-interest, they're likely not to come forward and give information. If their self-interest dictates that they not give information, they won't. If their self-interest dictates that they ought to in order to save themselves some time or some trouble, they will do it. I have not found in my cases, although I'm not naive, I know it happens, I have not found in my cases that diminishes the truthfulness of a story that can be corroborated otherwise. it does, to some extent, make you worry about putting that person on the witness stand. And in some cases, we've decided not to put people on the witness stand or believe their information because we believe that their interest or their reasons for giving us the information have been so tainted. Nonetheless, we take every piece of information we can get, we turn it over, we pursue it, and we try as hard as we can to corroborate it before we use it. I trust, again, that that was done in this case. I don't know. I wasn't part of the team. Again, the simple fact in this case is that Alice Lundgren was tried by a jury of her peers. She was found guilty, and in Pete Early's book at least, and I only trust that he got this information right, when they interviewed the jury after the trial was over, the jurors in that trial said that the single most important piece of evidence, they weren't so concerned about the informer's testimony, they weren't so concerned about the photographs or about anything else, the single most important piece of evidence that the jury relied on to convict Alice Lundgren was her videotaped statement in San Diego, where Alice, and I remind you, the jury saw the videotape, saw Alice's face, the way she reacted to the questions, and as you'll know, if you've ever been involved in a jury, you're instructed as a juror that it's not just what's said that you use to decide whether a person is telling you the truth or to decide how much weight's to be given to the jury witness's testimony, but how they act, their demeanor, their self-interest, everything. So this jury saw that video, heard Alice Lundgren say what she said. You'd have to be stupid not to know what Jeffrey was doing in there, and convicted her. And the jury, again, believed that that evidence was the strongest evidence against Alice Lundgren. Now, I respect Mr. Russell, and I respect what he's done in this paper. I think the response that he's made to the seven pillars of the prosecution, if you will, is in each case it could have, would have, possibly might have been. And again, we're not the jury. We didn't have all the facts. We weren't there to weigh all the evidence. The jury was, and could-haves and would-haves are mere speculation. The bigger issues in this case, I think, are issues that are common through all of these kinds of cases, and they deal primarily with the pathology as opposed to the doctrine. And in my experience, I believe that the pathologies that these people have are much more significant than the doctrines. And in fact, the doctrines are used by these people in a way to feed their pathology. Jeffrey Lundgren had a pathological personality. There's no question about it if you look at his history. And the doctrine that he espoused filled a need or a void in his particular life or whatever that fed that pathology and resulted in the events that tragically resulted in the five homicides in this case. Irvell LeBaron had a pathology and a doctrine that was as pernicious as any you'd want to be involved with that had developed around that pathology. And the results of that pathology have extended now three generations. We're dealing with the third generation of LeBarons who are now amoral assassins, who have no qualms, no difficulty whatsoever pulling the trigger on anyone. They have no remorse. They're as cold as ice. That is the result of a pathology, not necessarily a doctrine. And to close, when I was in Houston, one of the hardest things that I had to overcome was going from a place where I am part of the majority, frankly, and grew up in the majority and learned all the majority things and learned how the majority thinks and think like the majority, to a place that had no real experience with me or the way I think or anything else, and lumping me all together with everybody that they had ever heard about who was RLDS or LDS or anything, and assuming that we all believed and thought exactly the same way and that we, in fact, given the right set of circumstances, would go out and murder anyone. I think one of the other bigger issues is that we have to, again, separate the pathology from the doctrine, understand the doctrine for what it is, take it for what it's worth, do the best we can with it, and learn sooner or later how to deal with these pathologies. We certainly don't know how to deal with them now. We weren't able to deal with Koresh. We're not really dealing with the LeBarons very adequately, and I don't think the Lundgrens were dealt with probably adequately either. Thank you.
Just a real quick response. Maybe I miscommunicated on a couple of points. I wasn't arguing that Alice should have been let off entirely. When I said the toughest decision of what to do with Alice included the plea bargaining and lesser charges and so forth. And Judge Mitrovic, I know I wasn't clear on Judge Mitrovic. His prejudice wasn't in denying the plea bargain itself, but the statements he made while he denied the plea bargain showed great hostility to Alice, and those statements are on the record. But a couple other points, and that would be, yeah, the issue really is whether or not Alice knew prior to the murders what was going to happen. And, yeah, Dave is right. I do serve as a jury of one, but I have spent 100 hours interviewing the inmates in the prisons in Ohio, including 20 hours with Alice. I have received over 2,000 pages of letters, over 1,000 of which are from Alice, and have investigated, so in other words, I am more informed than the average juror, too. And so I think I'm in a position to make a judgment as to whether Alice knew. And then finally, I think the doctrine, my apologies to all myself and all my fellow Mormons, I think the doctrine is important. You're right that the pathology is probably central, but Jeff Lundgren's pathologies, I think, would have been worked out in less destructive ways if he didn't have such handy scriptures and traditions to rely upon. And so I think you've got to give the doctrine some weight, even though it's not the majority weight in these cases. But I enjoyed Dave's comments very much.
Thank you. We have a few minutes for any questions. If you have any, you're welcome to come right up here to the microphone and ask, please.
I have two or three questions of Mr. Schwendeman concerning the appeals process. I heard an attorney say once, and tell me if this is true because I'm not an attorney, poor pity the person, the innocent person who gets a fair trial, because the only appeal you have is on some error that may have been made during the process. So is that true, that her only hope is that there's been some error made?
Well, if talking about innocence, there's a saying that's not a real good one, but it goes around, and that is that any old prosecutor can convict a person that's guilty. It takes a real pro to get the innocent one. I think when you're talking about an innocent defendant, I think there are several layers that you've got to deal with. First of all, you've got to trust that an investigative agency is going to do the very best possible job they can to ensure that the evidence that they've got leads to a conclusion on the part of the investigative agency that a person has committed a crime, and that the evidence exists to convict them. The second layer is you've got to trust in an experienced and objective and honest prosecutor who makes a decision on that evidence to decide whether to prosecute or not. The third is you've got to rely on the system that we've got, which is all we've got, and that is a trial. And if you've ever participated in one, and you may have, or if anybody here has ever participated in one that's done right, you will know that there are a billion safeguards built into that trial to ensure that the defendant gets the best. Now, that all said, if in the end a person has had that trial and he's been convicted or she's been convicted, there are appeals. The appeals, again, shift the appeal process shifts the burden onto the defendant to show that errors were made, and those are legal errors, not factual errors.
Right.
The only legal issue that can be brought up relevant to facts on an appeal is that the facts were not sufficient to support the verdict. And you can make that legal appeal. The burden is very high. You have to show that a reasonable jury, given that evidence, would never have convicted under the circumstances. And you look at all the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. So, yes, your point's correct. If you're innocent and you're convicted and you go on appeal, I hope that someone in the system discovers that and you're found out and let go. But the chances are not good.
My other question is on the sentencing, and you didn't talk about that, the 150 years. If you take the worst-case scenario, it seems like that she knew. The worst you can say for it, seems to me, is that she knew about it. She knew her husband was going to murder those people, but she didn't know anything. But she didn't do anything to stop him. I don't think that 150 years is an awfully long time for that. Is there some way that the sentence, somebody might agree with that point of view and have the sentence reduced?
Yeah, a sentence can be appealed. I don't know the Ohio process. I know that in the federal system, if a person were given a sentence that was extraordinarily high under the guidelines or whatever, and there was a legal basis for challenging that sentence, you could do that. I'm not in a position to second-guess what the judge did with respect to the 150 years. That's a long sentence, there's no question. It's a tough one, given the facts in this case, maybe more severe than it needed to be, but it was certainly within the range of sentences that the judge had that he could give. That's usually the only test that you've got.
So. It's within the range, but it's at the very top end of the range. Maximum Paul was Maximum Paul.
Yeah. But as I understand his history, this was not out of the ordinary for him. In other words, he didn't single out Alice for special treatment. If you're talking about somebody who was minimum Mike or something, and he was given out 6 months and a year for real serious offenses, and all of a sudden unloaded on somebody with 150 years, then you might have a problem. If you've got a guy who sentences big routinely and sentenced big in this case, I don't know.
Okay. Yes.
When is Lundgren expected to die?
Jeff Lundgren does not expect to die. Christ will save him and break down the walls of the prison. But when did the state of Ohio expect him to die? The people of the public defender's office in Columbus tell me that in Ohio it averages 8 to 10 years. However, they have not executed anybody yet since the moratorium, or whatever you want to call it, that occurred in the 70s. So it's 1981 is the oldest case on Ohio's death row, and that person has not yet been executed. That's 12 years right now. But I would guess, just about usher in the new millennium, probably, with his execution.
It took us 15 years in Pierre and Andrew. So.
And what?
In a Hi-Fi case, it took us 15 years to finally resolve that. So.
Please.
I'm an attorney in California, and in California we get one peremptory challenge to a judge, so we might have been able to get
Alice would have exercised that.
That's also been proposed for Utah, by the way.
Yeah. The one thing that you didn't talk about, Mr. Schwendeman, I don't think, was the change of venue. Mm. And I do a little bit of criminal law, not a lot, and not serious cases like this, mostly misdemeanors. My experience with juries has been that they take their responsibilities very seriously and do give the benefit of the doubt to the defendant, as they are required to do in a criminal case. And I don't feel like I could second-guess the jury, but on the other hand, given all the pretrial publicity and the tenor of the community, that sounds like that might have been a legal error, and I wondered if you would like to speak to that question.
Yeah, the only way you can be able to know that is to be around at that time and to actually go through the judge's analysis of the impact of the publicity on a potential jury pool. There are cases, as you know, Supreme Court cases, that tell you that if the impact of the publicity is so pervasive in a community and the judge determines that based on surveys, studies that are done, readership studies, things like that are presented to them in a pretrial hearing, if he decides that it's so pervasive, generally speaking, it's within his discretion to move that to a new venue where the publicity might not be so bad. I don't know. It's a call that wouldn't ordinarily be... that a judge would ordinarily be second-guessed on unless there were the facts and figures to support it. The fact that there's a lot of news coverage is not the be-all and end-all of that test. It's whether people in the community, because of that, have made up their mind and concluded already that the person is guilty without having heard the evidence. And when you voir dire or question people before they become jurors, that's the object of the questioning. Have you made up your mind, or do you give me the idea that you've made up your mind to the extent, based on what you've read in the newspaper, that you cannot be fair in this case, cannot make a decision based solely on the evidence before you at the trial and on the judge's instructions? And in some cases, that's happened. The Hi-Fi case was moved from Ogden to Davis County because of pretrial publicity and because of the pervasiveness. And that was all done on the basis of some studies and surveys that were done in the community. So,
is that an issue on appeal?
Yes, it is, yeah. There was a survey taken of 201 people in Lake County, Ohio, and only 200 that knew about the case. I mean, Dave is right.
It's not knowing, though. It's not knowing. It goes further than that. You can know about the case. In fact, the jury system is based. In the old days, the juries were people that knew about the crime, in fact, and voted based on their knowledge of the crime. It's not knowledge of the crime. It's whether you've formed an opinion that you can't change.
Thank you for attending, and we encourage you to keep coming back to the other sessions. Thank you.